So, welcome to session 5. I think we're doing 12 sessions in all. And so we're coming toward the halfway point. Now, at the end of this session, which ends, I believe, right at the end of May, I'm not quite sure how long a break we take, but June 7th to 11th is when we're holding our retreat. I will have thought more by the time we get to the retreat about how to integrate that, or how that relates, but to the material that we're presenting here. I think it will be pretty closely related because there's a lot of things we could look at, you know, in a more intensive way, things that we've been discussing and will be discussing over the coming weeks. And by intensive, I mean something like really encouraging ourselves to return to the fundamental insights that we're looking at. So I think the retreat's going to be great, and will, I'm pretty sure, be closely connected to the things we've been looking at. Couple of other practical things. One is that I actually wrote a short orientation for this class, but I forgot to post it. So I will post it. I will go over it today, first thing, especially the transition part, because we're moving from session 4 to session 5. But I will go ahead and post it as well. There was something else on my mind, but I think that was probably the main thing. In the list of exercises that's posted on, or rather the list of the week by week classes, units for this session that's posted on the website, I forgot to include when it rains, but I think it's, so I will correct that, but it's pretty straightforward, I think. You know, every other week we're moving on to a new unit of in the When It Rains study program, and so just go ahead and read that, but I will correct that on the website also. John asks a question about the cost of the retreat, and I don't remember, Kathleen, maybe you could let John know off. How do we say that? Offline. Okay, so let's go ahead and start with session 5. So we're moving, of course, from space to time, and we've been doing that. You know, we've been going in that order. We started off looking more at the fundamental method or approach and what it means to be exploring or activating a vision. That was in the early sessions. And then we started looking at space-time knowledge, and that's kind of the pattern that we're following right now, going through space and then time and then knowledge. And so we devoted the whole of the last session to space, and of course our focus was the field, and we're devoting the whole of this session to time, and I think it's fair to say that our focus is the self for this whole session. Now, in terms of transition, I think it's really important, you know, and it's tempting to do this, it's important not to say, well, we're done with space now, you know, and now we'll move on to time, and we'll just look at it, you know, we'll just look at the time element. And in one way, that's right. But the notion of reality as given in the context of a field, or the notion of the field of space as the reality that we experience and engage and inhabit, is really central. And, you know, I think it continues to inform what we're doing in this session. So we're looking now at the field that centers on the self. And in fact, that is how we engage the field. You know, we engage the field in terms of meaningful structures, and we talked about that last time. And those meaningful structures really center on the self. The field is also, you could say, the story, because that's another theme we're going to be looking at, is the way the way we experience reality or experience in terms of the story that shapes the field. And that story is given by time. And so when we start to look at the self and start to look at the story that gives meaning and structure to the field, then we naturally focus on time. But we're still operating with this understanding, I would say, that it's better or useful to continue to look in terms of a field. And you could actually say that, and I mean, I think this is really true on a very fundamental level, that a field oriented view of reality, which is seen in terms of space, is the alternative to a self-centered view of reality. You know, if we start to see everything is given by the field, including the sense of a self that is at the center of the field, then everything becomes very interesting and very potentially very liberating, because we no longer need to focus on the self in the same way. But in order to make that kind of shift, we do need to look at the dynamic, because the dynamic that is temporal, because that's how the self, you know, when you're telling a story, you're already engaged with a self. Because the self is the one that, the self is organized in terms of a narrative. The past, the present, and the future. It's my past, my present, my future. So really, in terms of a transition, I'm just suggesting don't give up on the idea of, or you should say the vision, really, of reality as a field. And now we're going to move into the temporal dimension of what that means. That's how we're getting started, and the transition that I wrote and will post now, even though it's a transition to the past, talks about that. So you can go back and review that. Usually when I write things up, of course, they're a little bit more coherent than when I say something on these phone calls. So it might be helpful to go back and look at how I've described that. So now we're going to start looking at the material that introduces this session, and we're starting with Love of Knowledge. There are actually two chapters assigned from Love of Knowledge, and as I got into the preparation, I realized that it's not likely that we'll get very far with the second chapter, so I will probably have some things to say about that in the orientation for the next session. Because there's a lot to say about this first chapter. Of course, there's always a lot to say. Even just taking a couple of weeks break so that I wasn't actively reading in the TSK books, and when I come back to them, I'm always really amazed that there's so much in them. You know, they're so rich. So there's a lot to say. Ron has a comment about that. He says, one of the most valuable contributions of TSK is how it illuminates the temporality of the self and the structure of dissatisfaction and limits. Yeah, every part of TSK has its own charms. But I do think that looking at time and the temporality of the self is naturally very engaging for us. Because, of course, we think in terms of a self, we experience in terms of a self. And whereas talking about space, I think in the beginning for most people, the starting point is to say, well, why should I be interested in space? It's nothing at all. And of course, we've spent a lot of time looking at that already. But when you're talking about time, people seem naturally to say, yeah, this is very interesting. This is my life we're talking about here. So it's natural to take a lot of interest in time. And so we get to do that now over the next several weeks. So I want to start by clarifying a couple of things that are said right at the beginning of the chapter that we read, the first chapter called Presenting the Self. And it is talking about the self, and there's some previous material on the self and the love of knowledge, which we're not reading right now. We may read it at some other point, or maybe we have read it. I'm not tuned in at the moment to that. But we start with the self and its central position. But this first sentence says, the self establishes its central position in descriptive and intentional knowledge through the structuring of the known world. So here are these two terms, and we've looked at them before, I know that, at descriptive and intentional knowledge. But as a kind of a refresher and also an orientation to what's going on in this session, I think it's helpful. I want to take some time to look at descriptive and intentional knowledge. And the third in that set of three kinds of knowledge, there are a number of kinds of knowledge that Rinpoche introduces in Love of Knowledge. The three most basic, I think you could say, are descriptive knowledge, intentional knowledge, and polar knowledge, which isn't mentioned here, but which we've talked about before. So let's come back to polar knowledge, or let's start with that. So polar knowledge is based on or makes the most sense when you think of it in terms of perception. And it has to do with basically the distinction or the division of experience into subject and object. There is those are the two poles of experience, so that's why it's called polar knowledge. There's the subject that knows the object. And that act of knowing is the basic model that we have for perception. So when we look at the outside world, but also when we look at our own inner experience, we can come at it in this polar knowledge kind of way. And the idea in polar knowledge is that it's the kind of time that goes with polar knowledge is this point instant time. Things happen just, you know, there's the moment of knowing. And then after that, perhaps comes interpretation or whatever follows. But knowledge comes in this single instant, this point instant. And that then is the understanding of the present. That you have when you talk about polar knowledge. And it's the understanding of the present and therefore past and future, because they go along with it, that we ordinarily operate with. So the present is this moment that is too small to ever catch. Whenever we look, it's already gone, right? So the present is just this little point that separates the past and the future. And that linear model of time is our ordinary understanding. So our ordinary understanding is really based on polar knowledge, you know, the kind of unthinking commitment to an understanding of temporality would say, yes, there's the present moment, and that's when things happen. You know, there's a subject, and things enter into the subject's knowledge. That's polar knowledge. And part of the problem with polar knowledge is that if you just stay with polar knowledge, there really isn't any room for a self. You know, in order for there to be a self, there has to be a temporality that spreads out. And of course, we try to make sense out of that then by reaching back to the past and forming our sense of our objective identity from that and reaching forward into the future and narrating them all. And that's what we're looking at in this chapter. But if you just start with polar knowledge, then you can't ever get to the self. All you have is the subject, which is gone in the next moment. And it struck me when I was thinking about that for this session, this unit, that that's one way of understanding the way that science, let's say, looks at the self, because I think there's a little ground for confusion there, a little potential for confusion. Nowadays, you can find a lot of books written in the field of consciousness studies or maybe cognitive psychology that will say the self is a fiction. All that's really happening are subpersonal events in the brain, right? Just little neural events that we really can't possibly have any access to. But when they combine in certain ways, then this story gets told about the self. And that, to a certain extent, sounds like some of the points that get made in TSK, or for those of you who are interested, that get made in Buddhism. You say the self is a fiction. Although that's interesting and helpful to a certain extent, I think what's going on is that science sees the world in terms of polar knowledge. And so then it looks out at everything else, the self with its stories and its concerns and its history, and it says, well, that's all just a story, and there's truth to that, but it's a fiction, and it's not real. The only thing that's real is the world that's known in polar knowledge. And that, I think, is a fundamental mistake and misunderstanding based on a much too limited understanding of what constitutes time. It's accepting this polarity and this point instant linear model of time, and then making some, drawing some conclusions from that, which are okay. You know, there's something insightful about the conclusion when you say the self is a fiction, but it's not going to have any impact, you know, because it's just sort of a scientific observation, and the self that is busy telling that story or telling any other story is left unaffected by it. It's out there, it's on the other side of the, or let's say, that self doesn't operate in polar knowledge, so of course it's unaffected. There's a couple of comments. So Sudhi says that the polar knowledge way, can that be said to be like direct experience? Well, that's exactly the you know, it's a very interesting point. And it's another way of getting at this distinction that I'm trying to make right now. I don't think that when we talk about direct experience, we're really talking about polar knowledge. It's very natural to say we are. You know, there's this moment in which we just have the immediate contact with the object, and then we come in and make our interpretations and so on. But that is a kind of a construct that we make. And we've gone over this before in various ways, but let me try to say it again now, because I think it's really important. The world that we experience is already a meaningful world. And another way to say that is that it's a world in which descriptive and intentional knowledge are operating, as well as polar knowledge. And in fact, polar knowledge is in a way an artificial construction, it seems to me, something that we use to make sense. It's of the way, you know, how do we interact with the world around us when descriptive knowledge is always looking backwards and intentional knowledge is always looking forward? Well, so then you posit something like polar knowledge. So when you say so that you experience, let's say, you know, in polar knowledge, and this is the way people talk about it, they say, when I look at, let's say I have a computer in front of me, and the computer, the body of the computer is silver, or let's say I'm looking at the top of the little laptop, and it's silver. Well, polar knowledge would say, you'd say, well, there's a silver patch, you know, the eye perceives this silver rectangular thing, and then there's all this interpretation that comes in later. But in fact, we always bring our interpretations with us. And the notion that there's this pure moment of direct experience, which is connected to the idea of there being this point instant, polar knowledge, is really kind of a construct. So the classic example, or at least the one that I like to use, is when you hear a car going by, you always just hear the car going by. You don't hear, you know, you don't first have this noise and it's unknown. I mean, you might understand it that way if you were trying to take a scientific third-person perspective and say, well, that comes that comes later. You know, later comes the car going by part, and first the senses have to react. Yeah, that's true if you're giving a scientific explanation. But if you're describing the reality that we experience, no, the first thing that happens is you hear a car going by. Unless you deliberately make the decision, which you can do, and it's an interesting practice in itself, and we do practices like that, to kind of try to strip away the meaning. Now, there's a lot of comments on this, so I can see that my lesson plan, as it were, is going to go out the window, but I think it's important to discuss this. We need to get clear about it. Let's see where we are in the, and I'm looking at the chat box. And so for those of you who are calling in, I'll just repeat these various comments, which are great. I love it that people are engaging this. So Sudhi asked, is it direct experience? That's the question I tried to answer. So Ron says, yes, because it takes a world as given. I'm not quite sure how to relate to that. So Ron, maybe you'd like to reformulate that in light of what I've said. I mean, I just don't quite know what you're saying. Ken says fiction as a construct, a constricting construct. Well, you know what I'm saying right now suggests that we do construct a reality. We're always constructing a reality, and a polar knowledge view doesn't allow for that. There's no room for the act of constructing or creating a fiction. And that's why you need to have a more expansive view of time, I think. And somebody, I see one of the comments here, says something about a more expansive view. So Ron says, how would you know if it's direct experience except only after the fact? Yeah, that's a nice way to put, or that complements the point that I was making. Let me say it that way. When you say, oh, the direct experience, so the silver patch, you know, or the blue patch or whatever it is, you say that was the direct experience. But in terms of knowing it, you know, I mean, you can argue that that's, you know, this is maybe something we don't need to go into right now. But you might say you could have the direct experience of a blue patch. That's a classic example. But only if you stripped away everything else, and then you'd be left with this kind of construct, which is, you know, the pure experience, blue patch. I don't know that it would really be all that pure. So Ken says knowledge is behind time. And that, again, is a really nice complement to what we're talking about now. One of the problems with polar knowledge is that, you know, there's an act of perceiving, and then you interpret what's going on. So the interpretation is always after the act of perceiving. Now, that's based on the construct of polar knowledge. I'm not saying that's the way it is. I'm just saying that's implicit in the idea of what counts as knowledge if you're relying on polar knowledge. So knowledge is always going to be behind time, right? You have to come along later and interpret it, unless if you were trying to be pure, kind of true to the polar knowledge version of reality, you'd say, well, the only knowledge that counts is that direct perceptual knowledge, you know, blue patch. But then you'd never know the world. You know, all the knowledge that we rely on is on that model, on that polar knowledge model, which really is the model of science and the model I think people kind of naturally gravitate toward, because we're all scientists, you know. We're all trained in our culture to think in a kind of scientific way. So if you ask people to try to explain what's going on, I think they come up with a model like this. Even, you know, what they call in the philosophy literature, they call that a folk explanation. You know, if you ask people, well, how would you explain how we get knowledge? They would tend to go toward this polar knowledge model, because that's the one that's pretty much prevalent in our society. But the result is that the knowledge that we rely on is already behind time, which means it's not really alive, you know. Okay. So Ken says, what about a broader, more inclusive time? And yes, that's exactly where we're headed. Now, the first model for a broader and inclusive time is a model which says there are these three different modalities. There's polar knowledge in the present. There's descriptive knowledge, which looks back to make sense out of what you experience. And then there's intentional knowledge, which is knowledge that's based on our own concerns and goals, based on our sense of who we are as a self and what matters to us. So that is an attempt to arrive at a more inclusive time. And in that sense, you could say it's better than just a polar knowledge model, but it commits us to seeing the past in terms of descriptive knowledge and to seeing the future only in terms of the goals and intentions and concerns of a self, which leaves a whole lot out. So that's, yes, we want to be broader. Yes, that's the model that's being described here. No, that's not a very complete or satisfying understanding. And that's why we want to come up with something different or explore a different vision. That's really the language we're using, and I think it's very helpful language. We would like to activate a different vision. It's really not grounded in polar knowledge or its two other brothers. You know, you could say there's the three brothers of polar knowledge, descriptive knowledge, intentional knowledge. But we want to get a divorce from that family. You know, we want to strike out on our own in a different way. That is, we want to activate a different understanding, a different vision of time, right now time. Ron makes the point, this is putting it in more Buddhist terms, mental formations precede contact and perception. So yeah, that's, without going into the technical aspect of Buddhist psychology or Buddhist understanding of mind, this is really the point we've been making. The notion of polar knowledge is really kind of bankrupt when you try to make sense of it, as when you try to say, well, that's how we know the world. Because at the most, it seems to give us this bare perception, this direct experience. And although, and this is the point Sudhi made when we started this discussion, although we like direct perception, you know, we tend to value that and say, yeah, let's strip away all the concepts, the kind of direct perception that polar knowledge would allow for, if polar knowledge were even something we could experience, would be this very stripped down version of reality. A little bit like if you imagine artificial intelligence, you know, artificial intelligence would operate on the basis of polar knowledge, presumably, although you could try to build in the other kinds, I suppose. That's totally way beyond what we're talking about now. But it wouldn't give you very much. You know, you would imagine in artificial intelligence, the model they use, I said way beyond what we're talking about, but maybe it's helpful to think about it for a moment. So first there's the perception of a silver patch, and then the computer would presumably start trying to analyze, well, what could that possibly be based on other clues in the environment or based on the size or based on what it knows about what was in the room the last time the computer got turned on, you know, and then it would conclude, oh, it's a computer. that's kind of the model that we believe in, and that's why I'm guessing, I don't know, that artificial intelligence tries to work with that model, but it doesn't really work, you know. And it's related to the, for the reason that Ron said, we already understand the world in a certain way. We already make sense out of it in a certain way, and that has to be somehow built in. Okay. Ken says, an imprint that sets up the footprint. And he's got a little smiley face, I think. I think that's a smiley face afterwards. An imprint that sets up the footprint. Yeah, you know, I'd have to think about that a little bit, but definitely there's an imprint. That's the descriptive knowledge aspect that comes along and, you know, makes sense out of experience based on the past, based on what's been imprinted, you could say. As far as footprints are interesting because first there's somebody walking and then that person leaves footprints. And so it seems like footprints take you back to the past in a certain sense, but I don't think we need to, you know, try to unpack that image so much. So Ron is reformulating. I asked him to reformulate. He said, polar knowledge assumes a world out there as given. Yeah, that's very true, and I have nothing to add to it. And he says, that's why bare attention is a myth. Well, Ron's very interested these days in mindfulness, I happen to know, in this definition of mindfulness as bare attention. You really cannot construct a world or make sense out of a world on a polar knowledge model. And by the way, that's one reason that, remember a couple of sessions back, we were looking at models and how we make sense of the world by applying models. And I think the reason for that, or one way of thinking about why we do that, is that models are a substitute for knowledge. We talked about that before. You have no immediate knowledge. You have no immediate understanding. And so you make a model. And that kind of works. And why do you have to make a model? Well, if you're understanding, because you think of the only real knowledge as polar knowledge, and the stuff about, you know, the descriptive knowledge and intentional knowledge, you just, yeah, of course you accept that, but it's not real knowledge. So then if you want to get real knowledge, you have to have some model that makes sense out of things. All that goes together. You know, polar knowledge is this remarkably powerful construct at the center of our experience where we say, that's what's really going on. And even in meditation, to go back to Sudhi's question, we say, well, I would like to be able to strip away all the interpretations and just get the pure experience. Doesn't work. It's not that that's not valuable as a meditative practice now. But you're not. What's going on is not really what you think is going on. So we've talked about that in different contexts before. So maybe we should start to move past that. Although, there's a lot of comments today. Great. So let me go back to the chat. Ken says, okay, yeah, that's nice, Ken. Ron says, bare attention is a myth. And Ken says, clothes come quickly. So these are the clothes that cover up the shame of bare attention, right? You hide your nakedness with your interpretations. And we have talked about that. I think we explored this, that image, which is in TSK. I think we explored that a few weeks ago, where Rinpoche says something about thoughts. And he says, thoughts are the clothing that experience puts on so that it gets to be recognized. You know, that's really what we're talking about here. Okay, and Ron says, if you practice based on polar knowledge, that's an anti-intellectual approach, and it's antinomian. I'm not going to comment on antinomian because that would take us too far. But it is anti-intellectual. And of course, some people will say, and I'm proud of it. And there is a reason for rejecting or for saying, you know, the constructs that follow in the wake of pure experience, let's say, are a distraction or a distortion of the pure experience. But that's not because first you have polar knowledge and then you have these constructs. It's because all the constructs that get set up do so on the basis of a model or a story, and we're really now going to be talking more about stories than models, on the basis of the story of the self. I'm going to leave it at that. And Ken says, spell check is often wildly inept. This is true, but I don't know why. I don't understand the connection. My last loses the stream we are swimming. Yeah, I guess I'm lost on that point. Therapeutic at best. Boy, people are just communicating dramatically, but I a little bit I've lost it. Pure experience provides therapeutic relief from the self's ruminations. Okay, I think that's a nice way of saying it. So we're still looking at this question of why would you aim for pure experience, and is that what we mean by polar knowledge? And I'm saying, no, it's not what we mean by polar knowledge. But let's say that the self is a story we tell, and this really goes more in the direction of the reading, which we don't have too much more time to talk about. But let's say we go in the direction of reality as a story that centers on the self, or let's say the field is shaped, let's go back into that language, the field is shaped through a story, and at the center of that story, as the storyteller and all these different persona of the self that get described in this chapter, at the center of the story is always the self. So when you are living in a self-centered field, in a story, if you're inhabiting that story, it's deeply problematic. And we've talked about that, and you know, I don't think we need to say too much about that right now. It's you always live within the limits of the self's desires and wants and its frustrations and all of that. So it's deeply problematic. So what if you told a different story, or what if you learned to inhabit a different story? And that's one of the big options, you know, one of the big possibilities that people explore and different traditions explore. And the notion of pure experience from that point of view is something I would say is something like inhabiting a different story. You strip away, although that may not be the way it works in practice, but you strip away the concerns of the self, and you're left with something that's pure in that sense. You know, it's like it's not biased toward the concerns of the self, and it's pure. And that is, as Ron has written here, it's a relief from the ruminations of the self, the concerns of the self. But you still are left with the question, you know, have you now arrived at the truth of the way things are, or have you simply arrived at a much more inherently pleasing and fulfilling even version or, you know, story of what's going on? So let's imagine we're talking about meditation now. So let's imagine you focus on the breath. Okay. Most of you are familiar with that practice. So you focus on the breath, and after a while, you really get involved with the breath. And all that is going on in your experience is the breath, right? There's just breathing in, breathing out. And there's not even anybody aware of the breathing in and breathing out. The awareness rides on the breath, as we sometimes say in Nyingma when we're teaching this kind of meditation. So it's just breathing in, breathing out. And there is something, it's like that's the whole universe, and the universe becomes very rich and very full, even though it seems like you've stripped it down or you've narrowed it down a lot. That's the idea in meditation, or not the idea, but know, that's some of the value that we see in meditation. Does that take you to a vision of reality in which time has been transformed and space has been transformed and knowledge has been transformed? Well, and I would say no, it doesn't. It's a particular response. You could say it's a different set of possibilities. You might even say it's a second level experience of time and space, because time and space will certainly be very different in a world that, you know, just the breath world. Let's just think of it as the breath world. And in the breath world, time and space are going to be very, very different. All that is very interesting. But and healing, as Ron says, therapeutic. But TSK, the possibility of enacting a new vision of reality, that's something quite different. Ken McKeon invites people to look at Ralph Ellison on telling different stories or inhabiting or living different stories. Ron talks about self-censorship, but I'd need some context for that. Okay, well, great. I mean, I hope that helped clarify things. These are really important issues we've been talking about. Let's see what we can do in the few minutes that remain to try to clarify where we're headed in this chapter. So we've already talked about, in passing, we've talked about descriptive knowledge pointing toward the past, and about intentional knowledge, which is the knowledge that is shaped by the goals and the desires and the wants of the self. So the self has its intentions. We're using the word in that sense. And so it understands the world in terms of what it wants to get, really, its intentions. And that is really fundamental to the way we ordinarily understand the world. So in the reading, Rinpoche says that the self is the agent that organizes experience. It's the perceiver, the actor, and the knower. I'm just running through some of the things that are said in this reading. The self seizes the past, it authenticates the present, and it projects the unfolding of the future. So the self does all of those different things. And in doing that, it ignores the polar self model, because none of that could happen in a polar knowledge model, because none of that could happen in polar knowledge for the reason we've been talking about. So when we're asked to explain something, we fall into this polar knowledge understanding of what's going on. But in terms of the way we live our lives, that really is pretty irrelevant, which is one reason that, you know, that science doesn't have a lot of impact, you know, and the insights of science don't have a lot of impact on the way we live our lives. They're really built on a different construct. They're built on the polar knowledge model, which has nothing to do with our lives, really. What our lives are about, the self and its concerns and its self-description, you could say. So our lives, it's very well put here, you know, the self seizes the past, authenticates the present, and projects the unfolding of the future. And that triple movement, that's the reality we live in. That's what the self is always doing. And it does it really by telling a story, by making sense of experience through a story in which the central character, the central actor, is always the self. So in the text, and we're still really just on the first page of this chapter, it says that knowledge disappears. When the self is busy creating this story, knowledge disappears in favor of the intentions and concerns of the self. It's four lines down in the second paragraph on that page. I want to make a slightly different point, although it's very much related, and that is that I'd like to make the comparison to space. You know, in the last session we were talking about how space, when we understand reality in terms of objects appearing to a subject, and that, again, is related to polar knowledge. We can see that now. When we understand it that way, then space itself disappears. And the whole allowing quality, the whole openness and freedom of space disappears. So what about here? When time turns out to be a function of the concerns and self-understanding of the self, well, I think you can say the same thing. Time disappears. When we're looking, when we rely on intentional knowledge and descriptive knowledge, time disappears. That's what we want to really be exploring here. We live in a world in which we tell this story, we interpret experience, we give meaning, and it's a meaningful world, but it's meaningful in terms of the self, and because we're not really going to try to confront the self head on. I mean, that would, you know, for reasons that Rinpoche discusses at various places, that's probably not a very good strategy. But what matters here is that self-understanding and the stories that the self creates are intimately related to a certain understanding of time. And it's this past, present, future understanding of time, which the structures of intentional knowledge and descriptive knowledge, those completely support the organization of time. Now we're so committed to that you know, you can hardly imagine doing anything else. I mean, of course, there's past and present and future, right? And the answer is yes, on a certain level. But when we talk about past and present and future, those are categories or those are ways of making sense that arise within the story. They're not more fundamental than the story. So that's what we're going to want to be looking at. Now, we really are out of time, and we're not going to be able to get any further with that right now. There is a practice I'd like you to work with that is about that during the week, what we've been calling now the walkabout practice. But I'll describe that in the orientation. I won't try to do it right now. Sudhi asks a question, and since she started our discussion, we'll let her close it. Does time disappearing mean that the multidimensional aspect of different times disappears? Well, yes. I wouldn't put it quite that way, but it is a helpful way to think about it. And what you ought to do is look in the reading, look in this chapter at the discussion of single-minded knowing, because I think that that discussion, which comes up, it's in this chapter starting on page 174. There's a certain form of understanding that arises, and it says here that's based on the founding story of the self and the narrative that the self puts into place. And it's linear, and it supports a kind of single-minded knowing, and that does stand in contrast to, or does eliminate our ability to access the multidimensionality of experience. So when we talk about multidimensionality, that's kind of a space-centered way of thinking about it. But yes, we really want to be able to rediscover the vast field of potentiality that time offers. And in the model that we have now with its past, present, future structure, and everybody says, I know what time is, it's past and present and future, but that model, something fundamental about time has disappeared. Just as in the subject-object model, something about space disappears. That's where we want to go. That's what we want to explore. So thank you for that active discussion. I will try to cover in the orientation some of the things that we didn't really get a chance to look into today. So thank you very much, everybody.